You can support this podcast by visiting patreon.com/themurderinmyfamily. This episode may contain unsettling material or subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
From 1979 to 1981, a disturbing series of burglaries, home invasions, and murders occurred in the peaceful Southern California town of Goleta. Located in Santa Barbara County, Goleta is a beautiful community not typically known for crime, but rather for its relaxed atmosphere, beautiful scenery, and almost constant 70-degree temperature. In 1981, a 35-year-old divorcee named Sherry Domingo was enjoying life in the Santa Barbara town of Monticello, 13 miles away from Goleta. Relaxing outdoors and visiting the beach helped her de-stress from the rigors of everyday life. Sherry found life here soothing, and her teenage daughter Debbie loved meandering through the streets with her friends and enjoying her freedom. A relative of Sherry's in Goleta decided to put her home up for sale. Since she wanted to go up to Northern California, the relative invited Sherry to live in her home rent-free until it sold. Financially, it made sense to Sherry, and the timing couldn't be better as Sherry got laid off from her job that summer. The home at 449 Toltec Way was perfect for Sherry and Debbie, but after moving in, the typical stresses and rifts that develop between a parent and teenager surfaced, and Sherry and Debbie started to argue more frequently. Before long, Debbie was essentially out of the house and staying with friends off and on. When she did come home, the two would usually find themselves in yet another argument. During one of these arguments, Debbie told Sherry to just stay out of her life before she stormed out. Debbie didn't know it at the time, but she would never talk to her mother again. Sherry was frustrated by the situation and the arguing. After all, she did love Debbie very much, and they had been close. Sherry often found herself lonely without Debbie around, and would sometimes reach out to her on-again, off-again boyfriend, 27-year-old Greg Sanchez. Sanchez had mentioned to Sherry that they should get married, and although Sherry really cared about the handsome 6'3" Sanchez, she felt he was too young, but she did enjoy his company. On the night of July 26, 1981, Sherry invited Greg over for a visit. Things turned romantic and intimate, and Greg wound up staying the night. Sometime that night, or early on the 27th, Sherry and Greg were surprised by an intruder while they were in bed. Greg confronted the intruder and got into a physical altercation with him, and was shot in the face, incapacitating him. At some point, Greg got to his feet and once again tried to stop the attacker, but Greg was bludgeoned savagely with some sort of tool. Greg fell naked to the floor, partially in a closet, and he died there. His killer tossed some clothes onto Greg's head to cover him. Sherry, who was also nude, was lying face down on the bed with her hands tied behind her back. The attacker then bludgeoned the helpless 35-year-old mother to death. He untied her bound hands and took the ligatures with him as he fled the scene. Later that day, a realtor stopped by the home to show it to a prospective buyer and was shocked when he found the couple dead in the bedroom. Police were called to the scene and started an investigation. They determined that although Sherry was not raped, the murderer had left semen on her body, semen that would years later yield DNA evidence that would help lead to the identity of the killer. In 2001, investigators using the most up-to-date DNA science linked several Southern California murders to one perpetrator, a killer known as the original Night Stalker. The killer was also linked to a series of rapes that started in Northern California in 1976, in which he was dubbed the East Area Rapist. Eventually, 10 murders were connected to the rapist and murderer, including the murders of Sherry Domingo and Greg Sanchez. Over a decade later, the rapist and murderer was given a new name, the Golden State Killer, one that would encompass all of his crimes across the state of California. In April 2018, investigators once again used the latest DNA tools at their disposal to identify the Golden State Killer via a public DNA database named GEDmatch, which is typically used by people for genealogy research. After loading the killer's DNA into the database, the investigators learned which family tree the killer was in, and then sorted through countless family members until they found 72-year-old Joseph J. DeAngelo. DeAngelo was a father and grandfather and an ex-police officer, and as the DNA proved, he was also the contributor of semen left at several rape and murder scenes in the Golden State Killer series. He was arrested and is currently awaiting trial. When Sherry Domingo was murdered, her daughter Debbie's world was turned upside down, and she embarked on a decades-long search for justice. Debbie joined me to discuss her journey and how Sherry's and Greg's 1981 murders impacted her life. So thanks for joining me today, Debbie. I really appreciate you coming on to talk about your mom's murder and Greg's murder with us.
It's nice to talk to you again, Mike. Thank you.
You know, over the last couple of years, you and I have talked a lot and we've become friends, and you've been so visible on television and podcast. I sometimes feel that everybody knows who you are or has heard your story, but I'm sure there's people out there that haven't heard it or they're moved enough that they want to hear it again. So, you know, talking about your mom and her boyfriend, Greg, they were murdered in Goleta in California in July of 1981. It wasn't until years later that you found out that they were victims of the original Night Stalker, who went on to become the infamous Golden State Killer. If you can, just tell us a little bit about who your mom is, because I think sometimes that gets overlooked as far as who the person actually was. Tell us a little bit about her and who she was and what you remember about her.
Okay, well, my mom, she was mother to myself and my younger brother, Dave. He's a year younger than I am. She and my dad had divorced when I was about 12. And shortly thereafter, she met Greg Sanchez. And so she and Greg dated for probably about 4 years off and on. She, for the most of the time that I lived with her, just her and I, for those early teenage years, she worked quite a bit. She was a hard worker. She worked as a administrative secretary, office manager kind of a thing. So she always demonstrated for me just a really good work ethic. But as a teenager, that kind of gave me a lot of freedom. So I was pretty independent, and she and I were very close. We enjoyed spending time on the beach together, shopping, doing fun kinds of mother-daughter stuff. But as I got older, she and I I would push the limits a little bit, and she and I would argue quite a bit. You know, once I started to kind of push the envelope, push the boundaries, so to speak, she did her best to try and tighten up the rules on me. And, you know, she was just trying to be a good mom. She was looking out for me. And she realized that, you know, sometimes I was headed down paths that I shouldn't have been going down as such a young person. And so she tried to kind of put her foot down and say, nope, I'm the mom and this is what I say goes. And I was, you know, I wasn't having any of that. I was like, hey, you know what? I ride my bicycle all over town. So, you know, who are you to say where I go and who I see? So we kind of went round and round a little bit, but she always had my best interest at heart. And she was very, very loving, very nurturing, and very positive. She was a very optimistic kind of person. So I had seen her go through, you know, some challenges in her life, and she always seemed to land on her feet. And I just always kind of had this sense that even if things weren't perfect, I always had this sense that everything was going to work out okay, because she instilled that optimism in me as well. So I've always been really grateful for that.
So it was essentially typically the teenage rebellion type of stuff going on.
Yeah. Kind of, sort of, you know, things like curfews, and man, I pushed it. My dad lives several hundred miles away, and I've spent time in both households. I lived sometimes with my dad and sometimes with my mom. And when I was at my dad's house, I had started dating a boy that I really liked. So when I would be back at my mom's house, I would run up the phone bills talking to this guy that was that was far away. So, you know, I'd run up phone bills, and I was, you know, staying out late past curfew, and I was smoking cigarettes, and, you know, all those kinds of things that, you know, parents are like, no, you can't do that. So we had our round and round, and our last conversation was pretty ugly. I called her demanding something, and she was saying, nope, you can't do that. And I ended up screaming something ugly at her and hanging up the phone. And then the next day I got the call that I needed to come home, that something pretty tragic had happened, and I needed to get my butt home. And that's when I found out that she had been murdered. And that's, of course, that's the last thing anybody ever thinks. You know, nobody ever thinks that's going to happen to me. You see it in the news, you see it in the movies, but nobody ever really thinks, oh, I'm going to come home and there's going to be yellow crime scene tape and cops everywhere and a house full of blood that you're not allowed to go into. So, you know, my last memories of my mom are mixed, but from the time that she was killed, my whole world has pretty much been shaken. And that's been almost 37 years ago.
You were pretty fond, from what we've talked about in the past, you were fond of Greg, even though, you know, your mom and Greg were just dating. You really liked him Tell us a little bit about Greg.
So as far as Greg goes, Greg was really different from any of the other guys that my mom ever dated. After my mom and dad got divorced, mom dated a couple different guys, and it was never anything real serious. She'd go on two or three dates with somebody, and usually those guys would come across with this real attitude like, oh, I'm going to be your new stepdad. And those kinds of guys just really bothered me. And fortunately, there weren't very many of those. And my mom and Greg got really close really quick. And Greg was different. Greg was very down to earth. He was personable and he was easygoing. And I just always got the idea from him, what he exuded to me was, you know what? I love your mom. I love spending time with her. I love spending time with you guys. And, you know, it is what it is. And he never really tried to push himself into my life. And so I respected that. And Greg was a little bit younger than my mom. He was about 7 years younger than she was. So he was actually, you know, between my age and her age. So I never really saw him as that stepfatherly type. I saw him more as just mom's boyfriend. And he was part of the family. He never, in my eyes, he was part of the family. My mom and Greg never lived together. She always had her home and he always had his apartment. So there was never any kind of pressure like, oh, he's trying to invade or replace my dad or anything. He was always just really, really good to my mom and really good to me and my brother. And he was a lot of fun to be around. My mom and Greg both had really, really great taste in music. They loved to dance. Greg had just the most wonderful stereo system in his apartment. It was just, I just remember music playing almost always whenever my mom and Greg were together. And so that's that whenever I hear any of those old, you know, 70s easy listening kinds of songs, those always bring back really good memories of my mom and Greg.
So although things were a little bit rocky, you know, what was going on with you and your mom at the time, you seemed to have a pretty good, easygoing relationship with Greg.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, it's funny. He never really took sides whenever my mom and I would have our disagreements. He never got in the middle of that stuff. But there were times where he would say, all right, Deborah, now you need to pay attention to your mom. She just has she has what's best for you at heart. And he was always like reassuring like that. He never tried to pit us against each other or choose sides. And I always respected that too. He would back her up, but it wasn't in a way that alienated me. So it was pretty clever actually.
So in July of 1981, you touched on it earlier, you get that bad news. Tell us about that whole experience of finding out that they had been killed.
Oh, man. Well, Mom and I had fought pretty seriously a few weeks before the murders, early July of 1981. I don't even remember what the issues were, but I remember that she and I were in the house and were screaming at each other. And I just got fed up and I stuffed some clothes into a backpack and I hopped on my bike and I was gone. I went and stayed with a girlfriend for a couple of days and I probably called and told her where I was and that I was safe, but I wasn't coming home. And she and I, we were just going to have to agree to disagree. And I spent about 3 weeks that way. I would stay with a girlfriend until her parents got sick of me. And then I'd move to another girlfriend's house and so on. I spent a couple nights in a kind of a teenage runaway shelter kind of a thing. And they actually facilitated a counseling session trying to mediate between me and my mom, see if we could work things out and I could go back home and that kind of thing. And that was just a disaster. We ended up screaming at each other in the counseling office. I was just out there doing my thing. I had a part-time job at a movie theater in Santa Barbara, the Granada Theater. It's beautiful. I had my little job and I had my bicycle and I was all over the county and just kind of, you know, living a teenage summer. I had called my mom on Sunday, the 26th of July. I'd called her saying I'd want to come get one of my bathing suits. And she said, nope, you left. Everything you left here is... it's not yours anymore. You know, you're not coming here to get a bathing suit. And we went back and forth on that. And I finally, I screamed at her. I said, why don't you just get out of my life? And I hung up the phone and I was still fuming, but, I hopped on my bike and burned off some steam. And I tried not to really pay too much attention to that. But the next day I was at a girlfriend's house and her brother called. He and I were coworkers at the movie theater. And so he called the house and he asked my friend, he said, is Debbie there? Somebody called the theater looking for her. Anyway, long story short, I ended up returning this phone call. It was from my mom's best friend who happened to live right around the corner from us. And she had seen
the police arrive, and actually I think her kids had been outside and said, hey, there's cops in front of Sherry's house. So she had, you know, gone out there and to see what was going on. And of course they're putting up yellow tape and not giving much information, but she asked them, has anybody contacted Debbie? And of course the cops are like, Debbie who? And she says, well, Sherry has a daughter. So she called the theater and the message got to me. I called her back and she said, oh, Debbie, thank God you called. She said, you need to come home. And I said, nope. You're not going to help me and mom patch things up. I don't want to talk to her. I'm not coming home. And she said, no, you don't understand. It's important. You have to come home. And something in what she said and the way she said it convinced me that maybe there was something that was important enough for me to come home. So I had a friend drive me home. And, you know, like I touched on earlier, you know, you show up and there's yellow tape everywhere and police cars all over the place. And by that time, there were news crews interviewing the neighbors, and you know, people were standing around on the sidewalks looking over towards our house and kind of whispering and trying to figure out what was going on. So I walked into this scene that was just very surreal. It's very hard to describe, but you know, everybody understands what yellow tape means, but until you actually see it around your own home, it doesn't really hit. And when I saw that yellow tape, I don't know if it really registered that my mom was dead, but I just knew. I just had that gut feeling that there was death involved. Oh, man. I looked at the house and I could see my mom's car in the driveway. So that looked normal enough. And I saw Greg's car parked on the curb in front of the house. And as soon as I saw Greg's car, I kind of got this glimmer of hope. I thought, oh, Greg's here. If Greg's here, everything's going to be okay. And so I started looking for Greg. And the cops at that point, they're like, Greg, who? Who are you asking for? And I said, mom's boyfriend, Greg Sanchez. I said, that's his car right there. And it hadn't even occurred to me that he was in the house and that they were both dead. Those thoughts just I didn't have, as a 15-year-old, I didn't have the intellect to start processing things like that. But very quickly, my mom's friend ushered me over to her house and the police sat down with me and told me that indeed there were two bodies in our house and that they believed that my mother was one of them. And of course, at that point, I just knew that it was my mom and Greg. And, you know, my mind was racing as far as what had happened. I thought, you know, maybe lovers quarrel and maybe he killed her and then killed himself. And I mean, my thoughts were just racing at that point. I had no idea what to make of the whole situation. And then very quickly over the next couple of days, I learned just very, very basic details that there had been an intruder who came into the home and bludgeoned both my mom and Greg to death. And that's really all I knew. And honestly, I think probably that's all the police knew. They didn't have good leads. They didn't have a whole lot to go on. They were kind of grasping at straws and, you know, looking at patterns and acquaintances and, you know, who did mom or Greg know? And did they have any enemies and did they owe anybody money? And, you know, all those kinds of, things. Of course they were real interested in interrogating my father because first off, when somebody dies, you always look at the ex. So they interrogated my dad for hours. God bless him. And you know, they asked me dozens and dozens of questions and lie detector tests for both of us. And it was just really kind of strange. And especially being that we lived in such a nice neighborhood, such a middle class, comfortable neighborhood. Our crime rate was very low. This was really the first encounter that I ever had with a tragedy. I don't know how else to put that.
And you weren't around for the aftermath. You went down to live with your father in San Diego. So you didn't see any of the investigation or any of that stuff. But eventually, as time passed, you got older. You know, how was it knowing that the person who had done that had gotten away with it?
It's so hard to describe. I honestly, from the time that mom and Greg were killed, for the next 20 years, I knew nothing about the crime in itself and the investigation itself. I knew nothing. I would check in with the police, you know, maybe once every 3 to 5 years and just say, hey, you know, is there anything new? Can I talk to somebody who might you know, have details about my mom's case. And always I was kind of answered with, well, the case is officially open, but we don't really have anything to go on. And so I, you know, eventually I just stopped asking. You know, when it gets to be, you know, 10 and 15 and 20 years later, you just kind of accept the fact that this thing happened. There are no answers. We may never find the answers. And, you know, in all of that, I never really properly grieved. I never really processed what had happened and brought it to a resolution, because as far as I'm concerned, there was not going to be a resolution. So it was just this kind of open-ended, I don't even know how to describe it. It was just this open-ended mystery that was just, in my mind, was forever going to stay a mystery. And it was unsettling, but I just kind of tried to push past it and continue to live my life. And I didn't do that in very healthy ways at all. I suffered years of depression and several years of drug addiction where I just didn't function at all. You know, eventually was able to come to the light at the end of that tunnel and start functioning again and living like a normal human being. And right as I was doing that, right as I was getting my bearings and really starting to live as a productive member of society, that's when the police contacted me and said that they believed that that my mom's case might be linked to other cases. And of course, I was shocked and I wanted to know more. And they said that there had been other murders that were similar to my mom and Greg's murders. And they said that the MO was also very similar to that of a serial rapist that had operated in the Sacramento area. And I was really intrigued at that point because I thought, you know, all this time I've been thinking that my mom and Greg's case files were just gathering dust in some evidence locker somewhere and that nobody was ever going to look at them again. And so at this point, at the 20-year point, I was finding out that there was active investigation and that there were possible connections to other cases. So that gave me a lot of hope. And at the same time, I just thought, well, shoot, you know, it's been over 20 years. How are they ever going to come up with anything? So I had that glimmer of hope, but I wasn't really confident that anything was going to come of it. So I kind of maintained that open-ended, like, oh, we may never know kind of an attitude. And, you know, just continued to, again, just kind of to do my best at living my life with that unanswered question.
And you were one of the first or earliest family members of some of these victims to take to the internet and go on television and advocate for the case and spread awareness about it. What made you decide to do that?
Oh, wow. Well, there are a lot of factors. From that 20-year mark where I first learned about the other possible connections, I started trying to learn as much as I could. And the internet was, I was just beginning to learn about how the internet worked. So I would look at websites and, you know, trying to track down news articles from different crimes and that kind of a thing. And then eventually became active on the different discussion boards that became available. The A&E discussion board was the first one, I think. And the EARONS website, those were kind of my primary sources early on. And so from the early 2000s all the way up into, oh, I don't know, 2008, 9, 10, 11, you know, that was just kind of my learning process, trying to get to know the series, trying to figure out what this guy had done. And in that process, I was, you know, meeting people over the internet. You know, I learned bits and pieces about what the Harringtons had done, as far as making it mandatory for felons to submit DNA into the database in hopes of identifying this perpetrator. So I was learning a lot about that. So the Harringtons were obviously, they were very active as far as trying to help solve the case. And I never have met them, never have spoken to them. But, you know, of course, I owe them a huge debt of gratitude. But as I went on learning more and participating more online, one of the people that I got to know was Michelle Cruz. I got to know her online. She had sent me a message one day, and I don't even remember when that was. She sent me a message and she said, you know, you and I should probably compare notes. Maybe there are similarities between your mom's killing and my sister's killing, and maybe we could come up with something useful. So she and I started to develop a friendship, and I so admired. She was actually the first one that I know of that really spoke out and said, hey, I'm a victim. We want this case solved. We need people to pay attention and learn more about this. And maybe you have a tip that can help. And so she started to, she was making YouTube videos, participating on, you know, her Facebook page. And I was just really in awe of that at first. And I thought, well, shoot, you know, if Michelle can do that, I can do that too. So I kind of got, you know, gathered my gumption, I guess you could say, and I made a YouTube video. And once I made that first one, that kind of took away the fear of going public. You know, all this time, all these years, not knowing who it was and knowing that he could still very well be alive and blending into society. I know that I always had kind of this apprehension, like maybe he knows who I am. Maybe he could track me down and kill me too. And I was never really fearful of that because I thought, you know, if I was a target, he could have gotten to me years ago because I was pretty easy to find. But I started just getting this concept of the dozens and dozens of victims who were still living in fear, that they had come face to face with him in the bedroom. They had been tied up and assaulted by him, and they had received phone calls afterwards from him, and they lived their whole lives never knowing, okay, does he know where I live? I've moved, I've changed my name, I've done all these things, but does he still know how to find me? And is he really going to come back and kill me like he said he would? So, you know, when Shelley and I started making these videos, it wasn't just, you know, for my mom and Greg, it wasn't just for Janelle. It was for all the victims who were too scared to be able to show their face and say, hey, I'm a victim. So Michelle and I really felt like we were speaking on behalf of all of the victims of this perpetrator. So it kind of took on a life of its own, but we really felt like we owed it to the other victims and survivors to do everything we could to raise public awareness and see if we could help law enforcement, who were by this point very actively pursuing these investigations. So it was kind of a no-brainer. You know, we just felt like it was the right thing to do.
And this case really needed attention, and you guys, for the last 2 years, it seemed like you worked around the clock, just TV show after TV show, and, you know, radio interview and podcast appearance. And how tiring was that for you? It had to be tiring and emotionally draining, I would assume, to have to tell that story and go through that painful stuff over and over again.
It really was exhausting. And, you know, probably the hardest part is, you know, when you first tell somebody, you know, my mother was killed by a serial killer, the first thing they want to say is, oh, I'm so sorry for your loss, or, oh, you know, you have my condolences. And like you said, these last 2 years, the FBI did the press conference in June of 2016. And from that point on, we just thought, you know what, they put a reward up, we need to get this guy. And so it really did. It's like you said, it became a full-time job to just spend every waking moment trying to come up with ways of, you know, making videos and starting specific Facebook pages and Twitter feeds and all of these kinds of things. It was very exhausting. And at the same time, it was emotionally draining, but I don't know, this is so hard to describe. It's been very therapeutic to actually feel like we could be part of the solution instead of just victims waiting for somebody to bring us a perpetrator on a silver platter. We felt like we needed to do the right thing. And I'll be honest, both Shelley and I, both we drew on our faith in God to give us strength enough to just keep going, because we believed that the solution was possible. So there were a lot of times where you know, my family would say, hey, you know, let's just get away. Can you take a weekend away from the laptop for a minute and just spend time with us? And I mean, there were a lot of times that my family was saying that. And, you know, you talk about the travel that we've done, the different TV appearances, and just writing every chance we get, and reading all of the books, Sudden Terror and Hunting the Psychopath. And I, you know, just on and on, Jane Carson's book, so much research. And then to spin that around and put our personal twist on that and put it back out in a way that would reach people and touch people's hearts and make them want to help. It's been just this huge roller coaster ride.
And I remember back in 2017, at CrimeCon, we said maybe 2017 will be the year, and then it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But early in 2018, we talked, you know, I interviewed you for Criminology, and we said this might be the year. And then suddenly, a couple months later, boom, Joseph DeAngelo is arrested.
Yeah.
Tell me about finding out that news. Was that surreal for you?
You know, it's the kind of thing, this is going to sound really dumb, but I watch Friends a lot. And when I watch Friends, there's this thing where Joey gets an acting job in a big movie, and he's all excited, and he says, "Yeah, as an actor, I've been hoping for this opportunity my whole life. Why have I not been preparing?" And D'Angelo's arrest is kind of the same way for me. We spent all this time going, okay, this is who we're looking for. This is what we need. We've got his DNA. We just need a match. We need a name and a face. And then I got the phone call, and I watched the press conference, and I saw the face and the name. And it occurred to me. I was like, man, I knew this day was possible, but whew, I was not prepared for actually receiving that news, for actually seeing his face and knowing his name and starting to learn about his background. And I don't know, my hope has been reawakened of actually getting answers to a lot of the unknown questions, the hows and the whys and the what were the influences and the, I mean, there's, you know, all this time I've said, I just want a name and a face. Well, now we've got the name and the face, but guess what? Now that we've got that, now that just, that opens up a whole bunch more questions that need to be answered. So the sense of relief is there. And I think I can speak for all of the other survivors when I say just knowing that he's not free to do what he wants to anymore, that's a huge relief. All this time he's been living in a nice suburban neighborhood and raising a family and having a job and being part of a community. And he could have tracked down any one of his victims and come back and followed through on those threats to kill. So knowing that he's locked up now is just, there's no way to describe how much relief there is in knowing that he's behind bars. But at the same time, it's what I wasn't prepared for is all these years I've had this kind of, you know, I've pieced together this kind of movie in my head of what my mom's last moments were like. And I've always had just this faceless intruder in my brain who came into the house and watched and waited for my mom and Greg to fall asleep and burst into the bedroom and started beating and shooting and tying up and beating more. And I've had these images in my head, but they were faceless. And I've had that for over 35 years. And now that D'Angelo's been arrested, now that movie has his face in it. So it's I was not prepared for that. When, you know, you hope for the resolution, you hope for the identity, but I was not prepared for what that is doing to my psyche right now. And it's actually made those memories much more vivid and even scarier than I ever imagined. So it's been, it's been just over 2 months since he was arrested. It's coming up on the 37-year mark since my mom and Greg were killed. But these past 2 months have been probably more traumatic for me than all of the other 36 years combined. I wasn't expecting that. I didn't realize that I hadn't properly grieved and processed the trauma. And, you know, over the years I've been through, you know, little bits of counseling here and there, family counseling and drug addiction therapy and all these kinds of things. But I never really had done any specifically grief counseling and processing the trauma. And now I'm realizing, wow, I've got some serious, you know, I don't know what it takes to diagnose PTSD, but I've got some serious issues that I've ignored for 2/3 of my life. And so now I'm finally taking the steps to address those. And I've actually started seeing a counselor specifically for the grief and for the trauma. So, so these last couple of months, there's such a crazy mixture. There's the relief that he's been arrested. There's anticipation for the trial itself. And then there's this processing the grief that I've put off for far too long. So my state of mind right now, as you can tell, you asked me one simple question and I rattle on for 10 minutes. My state of mind is it's a little bit crazy right now.
And you mentioned the trial, you've got that name in the face, but now comes the court process. What are you hoping for or expecting? You know, this could go on for years. What do you see coming down the road?
You know, it's really hard for me to speculate because I don't really have any experience in the legal system at all. And quite honestly, I really haven't paid attention to the legal process. You know, everybody's heard of, you know, O.J. Simpson on trial and the Menendez brothers. And you hear about all these famous trials. And this one is going to be that way. I'm sure it's going to make headlines and, you know, made for TV movies and maybe even a feature film at some point is going to come from this guy and his crimes. And the trial's going to be a big deal. I wouldn't even begin to know what the prosecutors have in mind. I really haven't had a whole lot of indication from them about whether they're planning on trying individual murders in their own jurisdictions or whether they're going to combine it and go for all 13 murders together in one huge trial. I don't know what their game plan is. So speculating at this point is not somewhere that I'm prepared to go. I do hope that the officers that are charged with keeping security on him are very vigilant and that they don't let him kill himself while he's in custody, because I do believe that all of us, all of the survivors, we deserve to have the day in court. And whether that's, you know, one day or 30 days or 3 years worth of a day in court, the time frame doesn't really matter to me as much as just the ability for all of us to watch him in that courtroom accounting for his crimes, being accountable for the damage that he has done. I think we deserve that, and I'm very much looking forward to that. So, you know, I'm hoping that it'll come up very quickly, but then again, I know that there's a lot of investigative work that needs to be done before anyone's ready to actually begin the trial process. So, there's this balance in there for me that just says, you know what, I'm trusting the legal system to do what it's supposed to do, but I've got this little voice inside of my head and my heart that says, come on, can we get on with this, please? How long do we have to, you know, they say, oh, I just had this quote in my head. They say justice delayed is justice denied. And I'm starting to kind of feel that the longer it goes on, the more we're kind of saying, all of us are thinking, hey, you know, you've locked him up, but how long do we have to wait before you really throw away the key?
So this is going to be a new experience for you as you go forward and go through the legal process.
Yeah, it really is. In fact, as we speak, I'm packing my suitcases today. I'm actually headed for California this week, and I plan to be in the courtroom for his next hearing. So I haven't seen anything specific that's supposed to be on the calendar as far as issues that need to be addressed. I think this is more of just kind of a status update for the judge to find out where the prosecution and defense are, you know, in their game plan. But you know, over the past couple of months, I've seen, you know, on video and in the news, I've seen the previous hearings, and I've seen some of my sister survivors in that courtroom, and they're displaying strength and courage, and, you know, making this survivor presence known in the courtroom. And this week, I'm really, really looking forward to joining them and being part of that presence in the courtroom. So I'm a little apprehensive about being in the same room with him. But at the same time, you know, from what I've seen of him in the courtroom, he doesn't look around and he's not staring down the victims and he's not doing crazy things. He's actually just pretty motionless and kind of focused on just the judge. And so I'm a little curious about what to expect as far as his behavior while I'm there. But I'm really, really looking forward to sitting side by side with some of my sister survivors and just being able to be there for them.
Well, I wasn't lucky enough to have met your mom or Greg, but after talking with you so much, you know, I sort of feel like I know them in some small way. So mm-hmm. I'm really happy for you and your family to finally get justice. So I hope that's what happens.
Thank you very much, Mike. You always know the right thing to say. Thank you.
And just one thing before I let you go. If there's somebody out there that's going through, you know, something similar, has an experience in their background like yours, you know, dealing with a murdered loved one, and they're facing an uphill battle or a long fight like you've been facing to get justice, what advice would you give them?
You know, I'm so glad you asked that, Mike, because so much of the time, you know, I do these kinds of interviews and I spend so much time talking about me, us, our situation, our story. And it's so important to be able to send a message to other people who are in or have been in the same position that I have. And I know in our country, there are thousands upon thousands of cases that have never been solved. And there are thousands of people just like me who are waiting for answers. And so that really there are two things that I would say to those people. Number one is never give up hope. You know, especially in a case like ours where there is DNA and there are very real opportunities for a resolution, don't ever give up. Be as helpful as you can. Always support your law enforcement and, you know, try not to ever, you know, put pressure on them like they owe you something, but try and do what you can to be part of the solution and never give up hope on that. And then the other thing that I would say is avoid the same mistakes that I've made as far as the grief goes, as far as facing the trauma and dealing with what's happened to you. I think a lot of times, especially in our society today, we have gotten to a place where we have normalized things that are not normal. So, you know, you look around and at the countless numbers of people who are being treated for depression or anxiety or PTSD, and we just kind of shrug it off and go, oh yeah, they're seeing a doctor. They're taking care of that. There is so much that we still need to acknowledge about ourselves and about each other. And I would say, just do not hesitate to seek counseling, to do things that are good for you and put yourself first. Be a little bit selfish about your own health, because when we let ourselves we let those things fester in ourselves, it spills over and it affects every aspect of our lives. It affects our family and our friends and how we conduct ourselves in our workplaces and in our communities. And we really owe it to ourselves to acknowledge what has happened and to say, hey, I had this tragedy and it hurts me. And I need to figure out how to acknowledge that hurt and feel it and turn that into some strength that I can use to move forward. So I really, really encourage everyone to take care of themselves and, you know, just have faith and the optimism that things can get better. No matter how bad it gets, we can take steps forward and get better.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of The Murder of My Family. If you'd like to hear another interview with Debbie Domingo, I highly recommend that you listen to the podcast Impact Statement and check out the recent episode featuring a discussion with Debbie. If you enjoyed this podcast, please take a moment to rate and review it on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcast so that the show can continue to grow and reach new listeners. To learn more about the show or the cases we discuss, please visit themurderinmyfamily.com. You can also find us on Twitter or on Facebook. If you'd like to support the show on Patreon, it's always appreciated, and you can do so by visiting patreon.com/themurderinmyfamily. In each episode, I'll give shoutouts to any new Patreon supporters. Thanks to all the patrons that generously donate and keep the podcast going. If you prefer to, you can also support the show through a PayPal donation by visiting paypal.me
facebook.com/themurderinmyfamily. As we wrap up this episode, be sure to check out previews for two true crime podcasts that I'm listening to and are worth checking out, California Dreaming and Trace Evidence. And until next time, remember, every murder victim means something to somebody.
Hi, I'm Roseanne, host of the California Dreaming podcast, a show that delves into the darker side of the not-so-golden state. Together, we will visit some of the most unhinged and chilling crimes that ever shook California and beyond. Join me as I take you on a journey into a new story each week with a different backdrop from all around California, from the bright lights and glamour of Hollywood to the picturesque and tranquil wine country. No crime, no town, nobody is off limits. Listen to California Dreaming on the Orbital Jigsaw Network or anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hey, podcast listener. This is Steven, the host of Trace Evidence, a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and missing persons. Each week, I dig deep into the evidence, suspects, and theories revolving around the unsolved cases you think you know: Elisa Lamb, Aisha DeGree, Brandon Lawson, and the ones you've never heard: Lily Aramburo, Candace Hilt, Kanika Powell. If you're a true crime fan, haunted by unanswered questions, join me each Monday for a thorough examination of the victims, their stories, and the unknown perpetrators behind them. Trace Evidence is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, and all your favorite podcatchers. Visit trace-evidence.com for a full list of episodes, transcripts, and to subscribe today.